Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host Douglas Simpoga in Washington. Here are some of the top stories we are covering on this Tuesday, March 11th, 2025. A fragile power-sharing arrangement in South Sudan is threatened because of conflicts among different factions in Upper Nile State.
The problem is the lack of political will from the government. I would say that what brings all this crisis is because government does not want to implement the peace agreement, specifically the security arrangement that can allow the country to have a national army by unifying all the forces.
And women in South Sudan make strides in the information technology field, breaking barriers in a male-dominated sector.
I have always been passionate about technology and problem solving, which drew me into the IT field. Growing up, I was fascinated by computers and how things work behind the scene, while I was aware that IT is traditionally male-dominated.
We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on South Sudan in Focus. Uganda has deployed special forces in South Sudan's capital Juba to maintain security as tensions between South Sudan's president and his first vice president stoke fears of a return to civil war. Felix Kulaija, the spokesperson of Uganda People's Defense Forces, confirmed to VOA the troops are in Juba. He told journalist Mama Abraham Kuet the mission is, in his words, to ensure security in the capital, and the length of stay will depend on the situation on the ground. The South Sudan government and armed forces have not responded to repeated VOA requests for comment. Tensions are rising in Juba after the White Army Militia, which is allied with the opposition SPLM-IO faction, battled government forces in Upper Nile State last week. The militia captured a South Sudan People's Defense Forces barracks in Nassau County, and at least 70 people died in the fighting. Vice President Riek Machar leads the SPLM-IO, which has been in a fragile power-sharing agreement with the President Salva Kiir since the two sides ended the civil war in 2018. The rising unrest has sparked international concern, with the United Nations Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan warning the country was seeing an alarming regression that threatened to undo years of progress. The world's youngest nation ended a five-year civil war in 2018 with a power-sharing agreement between Kiir and Machar. For more insight, VOA's Paul Ndiho spoke to Raith Tang, a South Sudan National Legislative Assembly member and deputy chairperson of the National Committee on Foreign Relations, SPLM-IO.
The current situation in Juba, Paul, is very tense. There is a lot of tension in town, and a lot of senior government officials from the SPLM-IO have been arrested, including the Minister of Petroleum, the head of the military of the SPLM-IO, and a number of people were arrested. And the house that belonged to the first vice president, Dr. Machar, has been sieged for the last few days, and no movement, nobody's allowed to go inside his compound. So things are really getting into a wrong direction. The problem is the lack of political will from the government. I would say that what brings all this crisis is because government does not want to implement the peace agreement, specifically the security arrangement that can allow the country to have a national army by unifying all the forces. The government de-escalated the situation by sending more troops to Nassau town, which has been a spot where the civilian have been continuously fighting with the military, and this is in violation to the peace agreement, the security arrangement, because we have mechanism set up to deploy those armed forces. We have the unified force. Some of them were graduated, and the government refused to give them arm and weapon, and then instead they use militia that belong to certain tribe and taking them to Nassau.
Just for the record, you are a member of SPLM-IO.
Correct. I am a member of the SPLM-IO. I'm the deputy chairperson on the National Committee for Foreign Relations.
I've also listened to people from the government who said that SPLM-IO has sinister motives. They are not as genuine as they claim to be. They are trying to do some things that undermine the current peace arrangements that are there. How do you respond to that?
That is unfounded, because as we speak, SPLM-IO have no power in Juba. You can see right now, because our minister has been arrested and we can't do anything about it. And because the national security is aligned to the president. And for anyone to say that the SPLM-IO that has his leader, the leader in Juba, for example, you know, put in one place in the office and the residence. He can't go anywhere. He can't go to the church. He can't even attend wedding. And he cannot even go for medical attention. For the last 5 years, Dr. Eka has been sick and he was not allowed to go outside the country. So anyone who is saying the SPLM-IO have agenda, I think he has something that they want to use so that they can do what they want to do.
As a member of SPLM-IO, if you had an opportunity to talk to President Salva Kiir Mayardit, what would you tell him?
I would tell the president that he has to live up to his word, because he's been saying several times that he does not want to return the country back to war. And I wish he have to live up to his word and to show to the people of South Sudan that he's not taking this country back to war, because he has the power to do so.
That was Ruth Tung, a member of South Sudan's National Legislative Assembly and deputy chairperson of the National Committee on Foreign Relations. He also is also a member of the opposition SPLM-IO. He spoke with my colleague Paul Ndiho. Women in South Sudan are making strides in the information technology field, breaking barriers in a male-dominated sector. Some, however, say the government and communities need to do more to help women enter the field. Dennis Lugonyi reports from Juba.
South Sudanese women are increasingly turning to technology careers. Dawa Florence is an information technology professional working for a United Nations organization in South Sudan.
I have always been passionate about technology and problem solving, which drew me into the IT field. Growing up, I was fascinated by computers and how things work behind the scene. While I was aware that IT is traditionally male-dominated, I saw it as an opportunity to challenge myself and to break barriers. There were times when I had to work harder to prove myself, often having my ideas or contributions overlooked initially, but I learned to speak up more confidently, document my work thoroughly, and build a reputation based on results.
Lydia Taban, who studied computer science and works on projects for the United Nations Children's Fund, says the number of women in computer technology is growing. She says, however, there is a need for mentorship programs for young women.
I always stay committed to putting my best foot forward, to putting in a lot of effort, time, energy, and professionalism into doing the best job I can. I have started meetups, groups that basically revolve around technology that enable women to get into fields like machine learning and data science, making those concepts easier for them to understand.
Pony Henry is a computer engineer and project coordinator at the Bernard Initiative for Leadership and Development and runs a tech community at Seniors Hub, a youth meeting venue. She says there is a need for the government to invest in technology.
We need technological advancement in general in South Sudan. So if you can have more people being literate enough to know about the importance of technology, it would make sense for us to have a very booming sector. One of the things that I think I really, really want to push forward in doing is to find more technical roles for myself, as well as to create technical roles for people who are coming after me.
Yine Yenkenyika is with the National Communications Authority and is also co-founder and mentorship director at Go Girls ICT Initiative. She says the initiative has been providing mentorship programs to girls in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics to steer young women toward technology.
We've seen very steady strides, because when we began, our focus was university students, but quickly we realized it was important to think of programs for primary school and secondary schools. And during our engagement, we realized the importance of bringing teachers in. And as I speak right now, we have a demonstration lab for science teachers to experiment, different science experiments, before they go into classrooms. Our bigger picture is we want to see so many startups created by young people in the sector thriving in the economy.
Data reveal a significant gap in female representation within the computer tech sector. African women in technology face many challenges, including limited access to education and resources, gender discrimination, and the lack of role models. According to a report by the International Telecommunications Union, women make up only 20-30% of the information and communications technology workforce in Africa, and their presence in leadership roles is even lower. For VOA News, I'm Dean Slogonye reporting from Juba.
The executive director of Igele Farms is calling on government and non-government organizations to support farmers countrywide to fight food and human insecurity. Ibasi Patricia Tobbs reports from Juba.
In 2021, Ajo Noel Julius first established the 1,000-hectare Igele Farm in Torit County's Ifoto village of Eastern Equatorial State. He says his goal is to combat food and human insecurity across the country.
What pushed me mostly is to see that I fight food insecurity, which directly relates to human insecurity as well, because the people that we engage in farming, or the people that we encourage to go farming, oftentimes, if they have nothing to do, they become a source of insecurity. And therefore, by getting to farming, the desire was to create jobs, to ensure there's enough food for everybody. And in turn, it is a tool that will take away young men and women from engaging in violent conflicts.
Julius employs 80 to 100 people daily on the farm. As South Sudan struggles with food shortages across the country, he says farming not only provides food for hungry residents, but keeps idle youth busy and productive. Julius says those are two good reasons the government should support farmers.
If you support farmers like us, we're able to produce enough food, and that will relate that we're able to take away a portion of insecurity from the country. When there's food, I don't think anybody would want to go and cause insecurity. And again, when there is farming, I think you'll be taking away youth from being idle and engage, make them busy and focus on building their lives.
Julius is encouraging more young people to get involved in food production, adding that he believes farming is far more rewarding than office work.
We have a big problem in terms of attitude and how we perceive what work is. Because the fact remains that the so-called white-collar jobs or whatever it is that people are engaging in, I don't think it gives more money to the pocket than this other, I don't know whether you call it blue-collar or whatever, and white-collar jobs that people are despising. And so really it's important that what puts food on the table really matters.
25-year-old Albino Otwari has worked at Igele Farm since the beginning, digging and harvesting. Now he operates a tractor. Otwari says resilience has kept him moving, and the work he does supports his family.
I and six others were brought here in Igele Farm to do digging and harvesting, but later on the five left because they say the work is heavy. But for me, I continued, and the work is helping me support my family, siblings, and other relatives.
Despite struggling with a heat wave, Igele Farm's executive director, Ajo Noel Julius, says they are successfully producing maize, sorghum, green peas, cowpeas, beans, vegetables, fruits like avocado, jackfruit, pineapple, and other plants. Igele Farm is now providing food stocks within Torit, Juba, and other regions. For VOA News, I am Ibasi Patricia Tops reporting from Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. We'll hear what it would mean if women were employed at the same rate as men after the break. A British charity for the disabled, citing World Bank data, says the world could gain trillions annually in gross domestic product, or GDP, if women were employed at the same rate as men. The World Bank says failure to close gender and employment gaps reduces a country's GDP by 20% on average. Experts are calling for greater efforts to improve women's access to jobs, especially for women with disabilities. Muhammad Yusuf reports.
In many countries, women face multiple challenges when seeking employment, starting a business, or doing anything that will economically sustain their lives and those of their families. Gender discrimination alone, especially if paired with disabilities, can drive women into poverty. According to Sight Savers International, a British non-governmental agency that aims to prevent avoidable blindness and ensure equality for the visually impaired, global GDP would increase from $106 trillion to $127 trillion if women were employed at the same rate as men. The charity cited those World Bank figures as part of a campaign to narrow gender employment gaps in recognition of International Women's Day. Overall, the World Bank data indicates that failure to employ more women reduces a country's economic growth by 20% on average. 41-year-old Michelle Madao from Zimbabwe is a beautician living with osteogenesis imperfecta, a brittle bone disease. Despite her disorder, she attempts to help people like her who need to learn how to run a business.
I'm mentoring upcoming beauticians who are disabled. I'm availing myself, making them, you know, making sure I'm there when I'm needed, speaking to them, helping them build up their own businesses. Of course, it might not all of them might be in the beauty industry, but whatever line of business that I am familiar with, I'm always there to assist them because I also want to see them win, just like I'm winning right now.
Lydia Rosasi, 29, works at the office of the Kenyan government spokesperson, where she leads inclusive communications. Rosasi works every day to ensure that people living with blindness, deafness, and other disabilities are not left behind when the government communicates with its citizens. She says she bettered herself to stand out in the job market.
For me, one of the greatest pillars in terms of navigating this double bias has been education and skills development. This has been the crucial thing that has kept me afloat as I go through these challenges. For example, in 2021, I joined the IT Bridge Academy, and you know, at that time, the digital skills were gaining a lot of prominence in the job market. So it gave me confidence and the capability that opened my doors. And then I have found supportive mentors and leaders who have been very, very important.
Many African women struggle to get jobs, either because they were married off or became mothers at a young age, leaving them unable to finish their studies. Others encounter discrimination or sexual violence in their workplaces. Experts say empowering girls with education and allowing them to finish school is one way to reduce the gender employment gap. Liana Jones works on economic empowerment at Sight Savers. She says closing the gender gap requires policy reforms and cultural change.
In terms of closing the gender gap in employment and entrepreneurship, this really requires coordinated interventions at multiple levels. At the policy level, we need to eliminate discriminatory laws and regulations that restrict women's economic participation. For women with disabilities, we need specialised approaches that address both gender and disability-related barriers simultaneously. And lastly, we need to challenge social norms through engagement with community leaders, men and boys.
According to Equal Measures 2030, a coalition of national, regional and global leaders from feminist networks, civil society and international development, in at least 77 countries, women are not allowed to work in the same jobs or sectors as men. In Africa, only 5 countries have a full set of laws mandating workplace equality for women. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Chagos Islands are one of the last vestiges of the British Empire. They are currently home to a key U.S. military base. But under pressure from the UN, Britain looks set to hand sovereignty of the islands to Mauritius. Critics say the deal would compromise the security of the region in the face of a growing threat from China, as Senator Ridgewell reports from London.
The Chagos Islands, about 2,500 kilometres east of Madagascar, have been a British colony since 1814. They've been administered from Mauritius, which argues it was illegally forced to give them away in return for its own independence in 1968. Britain forcibly expelled the Chagos Islands population in the 1960s and 70s to make way for a US military base on Diego Garcia, one of the largest islands in the archipelago. In 2019, the International Court of Justice said Britain should cede control of the islands to Mauritius. Now, London is seeking to finalise such a deal. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer told lawmakers last month it was vital to secure the future of the US base.
Without legal certainty, the base cannot operate in practical terms as it should. That is bad for our national security, and it's a gift to our adversaries.
It's reported that Britain will cede sovereignty of the Chagos Islands and pay Mauritius around $116 million a year for 99 years to lease back Diego Garcia and allow the military base to remain. US President Donald Trump said last month that he was inclined to approve the deal. It also has the backing of India, which has close ties to Mauritius. But there are security concerns. Britain's Conservative opposition party has described the proposed plan as a strategic disaster for Britain. China has a burgeoning economic relationship with Mauritius. Some fear those ties could compromise the US base on Diego Garcia. Evan Fowler is from the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China, which focuses on threats from Beijing.
Mauritius owes China quite a lot. It uses that to seek sort of political advantage. That area is strategically important to us, and the Chinese understand this too. The Chinese have already been active militarily around the Chagos Islands.
After their expulsion, many Chagossians settled in Mauritius. Thousands also left for Britain. Frankie Bontom and Maxwell Evanor are with the advocacy group Chagossian Voices. They argue Mauritius has never had a rightful claim to their homeland and object to Britain's proposed deal to cede sovereignty.
Once again, we are ignored. People are discussing the future of our homeland without us. We feel like history repeating itself.
We now find ourselves, our very own identity, our very own self, being given to someone else by made of policy without asking us. We are still colonized. We are the lost colony of Africa.
Under the terms of the deal, Chagossians and their families would be able to return to the outer islands in the archipelago, but not to Diego Garcia, which would remain off limits. The Chagossians are eager to return home, but they appear powerless as geopolitical forces shape negotiations over the future of the islands. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama on Monday met with Burkina Faso military leader Captain Ibrahim Traore in Ouagadougou. Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger are three Sahel countries that have left the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, to form their own bloc, the Alliance of Sahel States. Felix Kwakye Ofosu is Ghana's information minister. He tells VOA's James Batty that while President Mahama did not visit Burkina Faso as an emissary of ECOWAS, the Ghanaian president said it was time that the region's leaders worked toward restoring confidence in one another.
The visit to Burkina Faso is the third in a series of visits to the countries that form the Alliance of Sahel States. So he has been to Mali on Saturday, Niger yesterday, and Burkina Faso today. The purpose of these visits is to foster healthy relations between Ghana and these three West African states. We all know what has happened between these states and ECOWAS. And as regrettable as it is, there is still the need to maintain a healthy relations, given that they are neighbors with whom we have common interests regarding economic ties and security matters, especially in an era where there is an upsurge in terrorist activity in the region. It is important that relations are maintained with these countries on the issues that matter.
I have spoken with some ECOWAS officials, and when you speak with them, it is not exactly clear what they want from these three Sahel countries. Did President Mahama take any particular message? For example, does ECOWAS want these three countries back into the fold of the ECOWAS community?
Well, President Mahama has made it clear, and it came up during the discussion, that he is not acting as a mediator between ECOWAS and these countries. At best, you can describe him as a bridge that enables channels of communications to remain open between these countries and ECOWAS. But he is not seeking to mediate between the two bodies. It is important, however, to appreciate the issues that informed the breakaway, because knowing exactly what their perspective is on these matters will help mold the kind of relationship that needs to exist between individual countries and these three states.
So when President Mahama says, he's quoted as saying that he gained fresh insight into the concerns of Burkina Faso and its regional allies regarding the relationship with ECOWAS, can you shed light on what the fresh insights are?
Well, as you may be aware, at the time that the breakaway happened, President Mahama was an opposition leader. So in that position, he had limited information on what may have triggered the breakaway of these countries. Now that he is president, and given that he is a respected statesman in the West African sub-region, it was necessary to find out what the real issues are. So it is in that regard that President Mahama has sought to find out exactly what the matters are and what the concerns of these states are.
What is the level of economic and cultural relations between Burkina Faso and Ghana? Is there any?
Well, Burkina Faso is our immediate northern neighbor. And it might interest you to note that we share cultural and even ethnic ties. There are people who live across the border who are separated by artificial lines, but in actual fact are relatives. And they transit to either side of the border in their daily lives. And if that is the case, it is extremely important that these ties remain strong and healthy. There are also important economic relationships regarding trade. As you see, Ghana supplies Burkina Faso and its other neighbors electricity. And these ties are important to both economies. Burkina Faso, as you may know, is a landlocked country, and therefore they rely on Ghanaian ports for the importation and exportation of goods and services. And that is why, as part of the visit, President Mahama has sought to highlight the important economic ties that we share and the need to ensure that they remain healthy.
That's Felix Kwakye Ofusu, Ghana's information minister. He spoke with my colleague James Barty. And that's all for this Tuesday, March 11th, 2025, South Sudan in Focus. We now leave you with the Yala Kitautu by Victoria Ole. You have been listening to Yala Kitautu by Victoria Ole. I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, on this live broadcast from Washington. For more information on our program, log on to voaafrica.com. VOA Africa is now available on WhatsApp. To share your input on our broadcasts or receive our daily news updates, text us on +1 202 322 7501. You can also follow our website's channel by Shari Basacheng for our username, VOA Africa. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Bill Androdi, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.